warm up.
That's it. Yeah, oops. No, listen. Just me and physician. So I've handed out copies of my lecture for last week and also for this week. So hopefully if there's copies in the back, you can pass them back to the front for some late people or something. So as I mentioned at the end of the last lecture, which was sort of a broad introduction to some concepts and ideas, today what I want to do is, first of all, I set up this couple set of equations. One, a generalized Gross-Kadiyevsky equation for the condensate degree of freedom, and another equation, basically a Boltzmann-like equation, and the one I set up was the simplest one, valid at finite temperatures, and it's the one that Claude discussed also in his lecture earlier this morning. But of course, it involves the thermal gas, but the thermal gas can collide with the condensate atoms, and also the mean field of the condensate can have an effect on the driving force of the non-condensate. So these are two coupled equations, and I call them the Zaremba and the Kuhne-Griffin equations. Now, we're going to use these, let me just tell you immediately, we've been able to use those equations to derive the full set of hydrodynamic equations valid between 0 and TC, which are the analog of the equations that Claude just derived above TC. In other words, above TC, we just get the usual expected equations of a gas in a trap. We've generalized all those using the ZNG equations, which are a particular microscopic approximation. Now, of course, we expect that the two fluid equations that we obtain, which are identical to Landau and Kolatnikov for superfluid helium, except with all the parameters appropriate for a gas, we actually expect that the two fluid equations are much more general. As we all know, fluid mechanics, for instance, is much more general than a particular derivation based on a Boltzmann equation. On the other hand, it's still impressive and important to actually derive such hydrodynamic equations from a microscopic, albeit approximate, microscopic theory, because that tells you the range of validity of the hydrodynamic equations, and particularly it tells you what the various relaxation times are in those equations, which are crucial. Then but before I proceed in that, I want to convince you that the ZNG equations contain, as far as we can tell, somewhat to our surprise, I must admit, all the interesting physics, and as far as we can see, give essentially a 1% type theory for any phenomenon at finite temperatures. And the way we've checked that is by using these equations to derive various, or make contact with various experiments in the collisionless regime at finite temperature and show that the equations give excellent agreement with these results at finite temperature. It's sort of sad, but just as at T equals zero, we now know that the theorists can essentially, within a few weeks usually, or a month, produce 5 or 6 physical review letters explaining any result at T equals zero. Now, it takes a little longer. It takes maybe a month, but we can explain, we feel, any finite temperature result in the collisionless regime, and of course this is no experiments yet on the hydrodynamic regime, we don't know how good we are. Then I'll briefly discuss how we derive these Landau-Kolatnikov two-fluid equations, it's essentially the same method that Claude discussed below TC. Then I'll discuss some experimental comments, particularly this, what is the appropriate relaxation time which comes out of the theory, and of course it's quite different than the classical relaxation time that we have for a classical gas. And also, in several places I'll discuss the distinction between the superfluid density and the condensate density, and comment on the fact that that's another region which we're forced to study when we're studying the hydrodynamic regime, but has its independent interest. Okay, that's my... I did this because I know in France all professors are instructed to give un plan. A good practice, actually. Okay, so this is my second lecture. I've sketched these equations up here, and I'm going to come back to them a little bit last time. But these are coupled equations, and they're coupled through what I call the collisions due to 1-2. This is terminology was introduced in the 80s by Kirkpatrick and Dorff, in which we have kept. But C1-2 simply means it's a collision process that goes from one thermal atom to two thermal atoms, because one condensate atom is involved. C2-2 is two thermal atoms hit each other and go into two thermal atoms, so that's the rotation. We will see C1-2 is absolutely crucial, as one might expect, and in particular, it's absolutely crucial, which we didn't believe initially, in deriving the two fluid equations. In any event, we argue these equations, which are still microscopic and include within them the hydrodynamic limits, but are also valid in all limits in the semi-classical regime, such as Claude. I don't think maybe you emphasized that today, but all your talk today was, lecture this morning was on the semi-classical limit. That is, TT is much bigger than the average energies of the particles, mean field energies of the particles, and TT is much bigger than the spacing between spacing of the harmonic trap levels. But since we do have experiments in the collisionless regime where the mean fields dominate, I just want to discuss what these equations predict for that regime before we go on to the hydrodynamic limit of strong collisions, omega tau much less than 1. And this is work based on, these results are almost entirely work of my collaborators, but it's really quite independent work of Eugene Zaremba and his postdoc, Brian Jackson, at Queen's University, who spent a fair amount of time developing numerical programs to solve these two coupled set of equations up in the top here. Okay. Essentially solve the generalized GP equation by a fast Fourier transform technique, and the generalized Boltzmann equation they solve by simulation methods using Monte Carlo. So sort of elaborate program, but they basically say that they can get their programs run So once they put in appropriate variables, they get one calculated point after 24 hours on their laptop. So it's very nice because you just need to worry about one point a day. I must admit, very little idea what goes on in these programs, but apparently they've checked many things that are very constant in these results. And presumably will share these to people who ask them in the programs. In any event, let me just remind you, all this is mentioned very nicely many times by Claude, the collisionless hydrodynamic regime, which is a very basic distinction in condensed matter physics. Collisionless means if you're dealing with some sort of collective mode or some collective disturbance that you can describe in terms of a frequency, but in this case, let's say, describe in terms of a period, capital T. The collisionless regime is when the period of the mode is much less than the typical time between collisions, which I denote by tau. Of course, one of the points of all this discussion for a Bose condensed gas is to figure out what is the appropriate value of tau. But let's assume we have it. So this means T is much less than tau, or omega tau is much bigger than 1. The hydrodynamic or collision-dominated region is the same sort of thing where the collisions are very, very frequent so that the collective mode period is much bigger than tau, or omega tau is much less than 1. And the crossover occurs, roughly occurs at omega tau of the order of 1. That's the most complicated region, but often it's the region one is stuck with, probably right now with the metastable helium. And of course, as I said, I keep on saying, what's crucial, of course, is to figure out what is the appropriate tau to put in there. So the first example, though, in the collisionless regime that I want to study, which has actually been discussed very nicely in Claude's lectures, is the famous scissors mode. And here I'm not going to give a lot of background, but I assume you've already studied Claude's notes very carefully, et cetera, et cetera. But the key theoretical paper, and we essentially, as Zaremba and Jackson studied the scissors mode not at just at 0 degrees and at T above TDC, but studied it for all temperatures in between by solving these couple of Roskadievsky Boltzmann equations. They can do this for any mode, of course, but they did the scissors mode, which is first, and it's probably a bad example, because the scissors mode is a very complex sort of mode. For instance, it has three different frequencies in general associated with it. Like a monopole mode or a quadrupole mode would be a simpler example, and I'll mention those later. But anyway, the scissors mode is really a challenge for this method. So as we know, David Gurry, Odland, Sringari in 1999 worked out the frequencies of the three oscillation frequencies involved. One of them, at T equals zero, only one of these modes exists, and above TDC, another two exist. Then the Oxford group under Foote, Chris Foote, confirmed these predictions, both at T equals zero and above T, and I'm going to amplify on that a little bit more. But more recently, they've actually studied the temperature dependence and the damping of these modes at all temperatures between, you know, essentially between 0.4 TDC up to TDC. And that's the things that Zaremba and Jackson were trying to explain and have explained beautifully. So the scissors mode, let me just remind you, first of all, you deal with an anisotropic deformation of the trap in the XY plane. In other words, omega X squared, omega Y squared are like this. Namely, omega X is slightly bigger, omega Y is slightly smaller than, say, some average trap frequency, omega zero. And the scissors mode, and it's sort of complicated, but it's excited by a sudden rotation in the XY trap potential by small angle. In other words, you've got the system equilibrium, you sort of do this, and then you watch how the thing sort of decays. Now, of course, above TC, the only thing that's a good decay, of course, is a normal cloud, and it involves two of these frequencies. And at T equals zero, the only thing that decay, of course, is a condensate quadrupole moment, as it turns out, because that's the only thing you have. At intermediate temperatures, of course, you've got both the thermal gas and the condensate. So, of course, in these experiments, what you actually measure is Q of T, which is essentially a time-dependent what you want to calculate, I should say, is Q of T, which is a time-dependent quadrupole moment, induced quadrupole moment, associated with the density fluctuations of the condensate and the non-condensate. Remember, non-condensate I denote as N tilde. And, of course, both are present at intermediate temperatures. And now, as I say, one of these frequencies, and obviously you call it the condensate mode, is only present at T equals zero, and then two additional ones above TDC. Okay. Now, in a very recent, I think, physical review letter on the 3rd of September, Zaremba, Jackson and Zaremba sort of apply our Z and G equations and work out what the foot people should have got based on the Z and G equations in the collisionless regime. So I'll just discuss. This is actually from a longer paper, but it's related to the physical view letters. These figures aren't in the are in the longer paper here on that, but on the basis of the thing. So here it's somewhat complicated, but I think very impressive. Let's just look at the top here. At the top, these describe the, you know, in these experiments, as an experimentalist knows, and as theorists we're starting to know too, you know, you actually watch what the thing is doing, and what we're measuring here is the angular displacement. When you tip this thing, you know, rotate the thing a little bit, you know, we're watching how the condensate goes back and forth, the angle, and this gives you the amplitude of the oscillation in some units, I guess degrees. This is the condensate oscillation angle and the thermal cloud oscillation angle, and both these results here, the top figure here, figure 9, are both for 0.6 TDC, so intermediate temperatures. You've got enough normal cloud, but the condensate is still dominant. Okay? What you find then is two things. The full curves, the black lines in both cases, are the Oxford data fitted to three damped sinusoidal modes, okay, with arbitrary constants in front of the three modes, and they determine these to the best of their ability, okay? I mean, fit the data to say, well, you've got three modes. It turns out often, particularly at low temperatures, as I've already mentioned, only one frequency, only the condensate mode has any sufficient weight, but in their calculations, you include all three, and in fact, even in analyzing the data, they include all three. So the black line here at 0.6 TDC is actually the best fits, not in some sense to the experiment, these are not the experiments, the best fits to the experiments in terms of three weighted damped normal mode frequencies, okay? Similarity here, the black line is that. The computer calculations of Zaremba and Jackson, or I guess Jackson and Zaremba, are shown by the dotted lines. I mean, looking at this, you could see there's no point in doing experiments. No point in doing experiments, right? In theory, it's just perfect. The fact that there's sort of a complicated structure in a thermal cloud is simply because there's two frequencies, the omega plus and omega minus, with sort of interference effect. Now, what about at very high temperatures? In other words, NC over N is 0.02, so this is key, very close, just slightly below TBC. Well, here, again, remember the black curves are the best fits to the experiment, okay? And the dotted curves are the results of the computer calculations, solving a couple of ZNG equations. Here you notice that, for instance, again, the thermal cloud is, of course, at these temperatures, the condensate mode is not too important. There's very little condensate left at point, you know, NC is 0.02 of total N. So the thermal cloud, you sort of expect, and you do still find fantastic agreements, okay? And all these little differences here are significant. I mean, there's, all these are quite reproducible and what have you. What you, interestingly, you find that there's not such good, to me, that's fantastic still, but you could argue, well, it's not such good agreement for the condensate damping. You know, these are known as damp modes here. The oscillations here as a function of time, slight little deviations, okay? And this also is explained by the Monte Carlo calculations, because the Oxford group found they couldn't fit their data to three damped oscillators. And it's quite clear from these calculations, because I haven't shown you, that they could actually make movies of what the thermal cloud and condensate are doing out of their data. And we find at these high temperatures, the normal cloud is huge and just pulling the condensate all around and what have you, and the condensate really doesn't know what to do and is really trying to follow the non-condensate. In the opposite limit of very low temperatures, the condensate is huge, and it sort of just rips the non-condensate around and what have you. All this is contained, of course, in the experiments, but it's also contained in the theory. So this deviation here is not a failure of the theory. It actually explains to people like Chris Foote and his group why they were not able to actually get good agreements. And that means in their data, when they plot the damping and frequencies of their modes, they show huge error bars. But they admit those error bars are misleading. It's the fact that they just couldn't get a good fit to three modes. Oh, the black line. The black, I know you don't like it because you don't like seeing. The experiments are taken, okay? I mean, are done. Then they fit the experiments, you know, some oscillation. They fit that to three, to the best fit of three damped sinusoidal frequencies with weights, and they figure out, you know, least chi square fit and all that sort of stuff. In this region here, their error bar is very, very small. Very small. I mean, you know. In contrast, when they get to high TC, they plot the thing as with big error bars. But in fact, when you talk to the experimentalists there, they actually say that actually around 0.9 TDC, you know, and above, they found difficulty. And one can explain it. It's basically that the scissors mode is a very highly nonlinear phenomenon, which sort of is not easily explained, actually, unless you do things very carefully in terms of linear combinations of frequencies. But I say, in this paper here, there's other results, and I'm going to mention other results that they give, but that it's arguments like this that we feel that one can, is in a very good position with these ANG equations. I might say that Nukuni, which is just coming, Tetsuro Nukuni in Toronto, stimulated by this work, has used a moment method exactly like Gary Odelin, Zambelli, Dalbard, Jean, and Strigari have used it. In fact, Claude has just reviewed recently, I think the last couple of lectures, where they discuss this method at T above TBC. Tetsuro Nukuni, with advice from me, generalized this method to below TBC, okay? And basically you get a whole bunch of new moments because you have to worry about the condensate degree of freedom, what have you. But it can all be worked out sort of more or less analytically. And he confirms all these general results the numerical calculations of Jackson and Zaremba obtained. With the one exception, and I'll come back to some of these things, with the one exception, I might say these dotted curves here fully include all Landau damping and all collisional damping. Fully. Okay? In the moment method, one of its great deficiencies is it cannot easily include Landau damping, which is the main form of damping. So one has that same problem both above as well as below TDC. I may say also, it's an interesting point, how theorists' Monte Carlo calculations, as we all know, are sort of in between analytical theory and experiment. But they're interesting from the point of view they force the theorist to think a lot about how the experimentalist does things. Namely, when you do a Monte Carlo calculation, you have to set up the calculation. You have to perturb the system and say, watch how it decays and what have you. And Zaremba and Jackson initially found the sort of following sort of strange results. Namely, that when they disturbed the system and watched it decay, they found that initially their results when they got out the damping was much less than you expect from Landau damping, much less. Okay? And you're surprised. Well, what's wrong? Then they found out is that and this was because they had left out collisional damping, the C22 and C12 terms, in a collisionless regime. And it turns out that, of course, it basically meant that they got the system into a non-equilibrium state, and because there were no collisions, Landau damping couldn't come into its own because you couldn't get back close enough to equilibrium where it becomes its usual value. Usually a theorist calculate using linear response theory. And when they then put in collisional damping, even though the collisional damping by itself was very small, it essentially upped the rate of Landau damping by a factor of 10. And it emphasized all these Monte Carlo studies based on ZNG emphasize how very important it is how you set up the experiment and what you're doing, which is the type of thing usually theorists like myself don't worry about too much. Now, I want to make a little digression about the scissors mode here, even though it's not related directly to checking the correctness of ZNG. Namely, the scissors mode, of course, is particular interest, a conceptual interest for a separate reason. Namely, you can use, it turns out, and that was first shown by Zambelli and Stringari, you can use the data from the scissors mode to calculate the reduced moment of inertia in a Bose condensed gas, in some sense, get the effects of superfluidity, and this is why it's often mentioned as a direct evidence for superfluidity. Let me just briefly mention how this argument goes, is that an anisotropic trap in the XY plane, this is rotated around the Z axis with an angular frequency omega, then the angular momentum in the Z direction is equal to the moment of inertia times omega. This is this perturbation theory, sort of thing that's done in Mazier and Pines' book in 1964. And this coefficient here called the moment of inertia, which in a classical system is simply above TDC, is simply given by its so-called rigid value, dr x squared plus y squared times the density above TDC to be n tilde. A theta, of course, moment of inertia to a theorist is actually a response function. It tells you what's the response function of the angular momentum in the along the z direction with respect to this perturbation that you've induced by this rotation. Now, so moments of inertia, as we know, are very interesting in superfluids because, for instance, it's supposed to become much smaller in a superfluid, what have you. Now, the nice thing about this theta is that Zambelli and Scagliari, for precisely the trapped gases, or only the trapped gases, showed that theta could be directly related by an exact formula, given by this, where chi, a double prime of Q, is essentially the Fourier transform of Q of T, the quadrupole moment that you study in the scissors mode. So basically, the information from the scissors mode enables you to determine this function, this response function, and in doing this interval, which is a little bit odd because it has omega and 3 in the denominator, you can work out theta, and then you can work out, in some sense, the condensate contribution and the non-condensate contribution at any temperature. And we've done that. The rigid moment of inertia, which is not a relevant quantity physically, it's just simply this, at temperatures below TDC, it's nc plus n tilde, that's the total density, so that's the definition of the so-called rigid moment of inertia, which is not really relevant, of course, but it still you can define it, also turns out to be given, this is sort of like a sum rule check on how good your chi q double prime is, it's given by this other integral depending with 1 over omega. So these results, as I say, when you determine Q of T, as I mentioned, the quadrupole moment of the condensate and non-condensate, this is a sort of complicated slide here, then you can get the condensate non-condensate component of the quadrupole moment, take the Fourier transform of it, multiply by omega and up to constants, that's at chi Q double prime. So in other words, from this Oxford type experiments, one can literally determine experimentally what chi Q double prime of omega is, and then put it into those sum rules and calculate the moment of inertia. And that was done originally at T equals zero and at T above TDC by Zambelli and Scardari and Odelin and others. Now, for instance, here, from Jackson Zaremba's recent Physical Review letter, I give actually the full three-dimensional mountain plot of this quadrupole, imaginary part of the quadrupole response function, which is measured by the scissors mode. But this result here is what Jackson and Zaremba calculate. Okay? And as I say, the results at T equals zero, this is temperature here from zero or 0.2 up to 1 TC, and this is frequency here from 1 to 5 in terms of the transverse frequency. And of course, above TC, you get these two modes that Zambelli and Scrigari and David have discussed, and also the one at T equals zero. And of course, as you see what happens when you're going in intermediate frequency or intermediate temperatures, the condensate mode gets lower and lower in weight, and the two non-condensate modes build up. Okay? All comes out of this coupled ZNZ equations. So you can use this to calculate the moment of inertia as a function of temperature. It's not a measurement, but it's still sort of interesting. I might say this whole thing, though, is very, very subtle for the following reasons. And this was shown by Tetsuro Natsuni in his paper I just mentioned before. When you work out this QC and QN, naively you might think, well, you'll get a contribution to the moment of inertia, which would be related to these two things. You'd have a quadrupole. You'd have a condensate contribution to this and a non-condensate contribution to this. and it'd be very nice. But in fact, unfortunately, that separation doesn't occur because the moment you deal with an interacting gas, which we're dealing with, the contribution from QC here to the to the moment of inertia is given by this epsilon squared theta, you know, rigid. And this is essentially the rigid moment of inertia with just the condensate density in equilibrium. So Q theta NC would be just this first term. Well, not, it'd be the moment of inertia x squared plus y squared times NC zero. And this other one, what I call N tilde here, would be the rigid moment of inertia for just the non-condensate static density. So this is the result of calculations. You find epsilon squared theta, the moment of inertia NC, plus a complicated quantity here, which is arising from interactions. That's from the condensate. For the non-condensate, you get a very complicated, you get this very simple result, minus A, very complicated thing, but minus this other guy from the non-condensate. And when they add up, you get these sum of these two terms, but it's very misleading because you can't really think of the two terms as strictly condensate and non-condensate because the effect of the interactions has canceled. So this is a digression. I'm going to come back a little bit to this rotational problem and what these studies do right at the end. In any event, here's another example, much easier than the scissors mode, still trying to verify ZNG equations. These are the monopole collective modes, precisely, in fact, what the sort of thing that Claude discussed today above TBC, or I should say below TBC in a hydrodynamic regime, the sort of the monopole, M equals zero modes, but they're really a coupling of monopole and quadrupole sort of modes in this sort of trap. These are experiments, famous experiments, done by Debbie Jin et al. At physical JILA in 1997, and they're one of the few amongst the first finite temperature studies. They also studied the M equals two mode, but I'm just concentrating M equals zero mode. And their experimental results have been very puzzling to theorists for a long time. Many theorists, of course, have explained the results. But most other theorists have found his results puzzling to the extent that even Eric Cornell doubted his data. You probably saw it. Probably his data was okay. This is the excuse of experimentalists, but the analysis they made of the data was insufficient. In any event, these are the results. Unfortunately, I don't show the experimental data points. So unfortunately, I apologize to Alain here. The little triangles, dark and light, are the theoretical calculations. Each point takes a day. Okay? But essentially, what this is the frequencies and the damping of the modes. I emphasize these results for the damping include collisional damping from C22, C12, and fully Landau damping, and the main damping is from Landau damping. And this theory is only expected to be valid around 0.5 Tc and above. But in any event, what was very nice about it is they got the thermal cloud frequency up here, and also the condensate mode, the frequency is going like this. And for those of you who know this subject, this sudden knee, as it's called, this jerk at 0.7, where suddenly this mode goes up, you know, has been a big puzzle. And it comes out of these calculations very, very nicely. So really quite exciting. This work is just being submitted, I think, to PRL. So again, it sort of emphasizes, it seems, that ZNG can explain anything you want at finite temperatures. This particular reflective mode. This is just the last thing here to do overkill. What about growth problems? I mentioned that that obviously this type of theory is very, very, let's see here. Yeah, this type of theory is very relevant to studying the time-dependent rate of growth of the condensate, which is always an interesting problem, how an order parameter develops. And obviously, this is going to be very crucially dependent on these C12 collisions, because when you go from above TBC to below TBC, essentially, the mother of the condensate is the thermal atoms, and they have to be shoved into the condensate to allow it to grow, and of course, the thermal cloud gives up its life and dies as a result. I forget this, but I think it was 99, this MIT experiment. It's really the only sort of serious experiment. I strongly encourage experimentalists to do more stuff on this. This stuff was explained by a series of papers by Kristen Gardner et al. In New Zealand, but also, you know, maybe a shorter paper by Bill Smith and Stoof last year based on the ZNG equations. But just to give you an example, which I happen to have with me here, this is an example, again, of this Conn-Matt recent paper by Jackson and Zaremba. This is an example of the type of things they can do. Here they start at T equals zero with this particular setup here, with the total number of atoms in the condensate and non-condensate to be 10 to the 2 times 5 times 10 to the 14. That's in their simulation. And then they start with at 200 nanokelvin, okay, which is above TC for this number of atoms. Now that I think of it, it's actually below TC. Not too much below. But then they quench. They simply artificially decrease the temperature by a factor of 2 to 100 nanokelvin. And, of course, what happens, this means the condensate has to get bigger and the non-condensate has to get smaller. And the green curve here shows how the condensate grows in time, and the red curve shows how the non-condensate decreases in time. There's a certain amount of little oscillations here. But what was very satisfying is NC plus N tilde, which you sort of expect, is constant, okay? So I might say in this stuff here, you have to really spend some time analyzing this type of curve, but this is the type of curve one would like to be able to compare with good experiments, which I think even Wolfgang would agree his experiments were not perfect, is that the initial rate of growth after quench is very important, and you can see the rate is quite different than when it saturates. And the results of Jackson and Zaremba can discuss that in great detail. Okay. Okay, well now, having convinced you, I hope, that ZNG should be taken sort of seriously in the collisionless region, now I want to finally finish up my lectures by going to the two-fluid hydrodynamic regime, starting with these ZNG coupled equations. Just before I do that, I just want to make a little review, because we're going to make contact with that, with the two-fluid, super-fluid hydrodynamic equations first written down, and I emphasize sort of written down, thoughtfully, but still written down. They weren't really true. It was within a phenomenological set of ideas in 1949 and then developed later. Basically, Landau's picture you can see in this, when you look at this very beautiful paper, which changed all of condensed matter physics and probably physics in general, is I know what classical fluid hydrodynamics is like, and I've got this idea I've got to have this separate degree of freedom, and he sort of grafted on a new superfluid component onto these equations, and somewhat with great brilliance figured out the appropriate new equations of motion for the condensate. You know? And in particular, we're all familiar with the fact that these are in terms of so-called normal fluids and superfluid, and currents are rho n dn plus rho s plus ds and what have you. And that this theory explains all low omega, low frequency, low Q, that is long wavelength hydrodynamic phenomenon. They're sort of the equivalent of the fluid equations for water or something like this. And later, as I'll mention, Kolatnikov, one of Landau's students, generalized this whole theory with Landau to include the next step past hydrodynamics, namely to include hydrodynamic damping, transport processes within the same sort of scheme. What's interesting from our point of view here is that Landau, as you know, some of the crucial ideas that Landau had was that the VS, this new superfluid component was going to move at a velocity which was irrotational. For various reasons, argued that that's the way it should be. He actually gave some arguments in his first paper for it, but later when he modified the paper in a crucial way to include rotons in 1947, he just ignored the arguments he gave for why it was irrotational. But of course, the fact that it's irrotational is, as we all know now, crucial, and of course the fact that it's irrotational is a direct consequence that's related to a Bose order parameter. Because by rotational, we know then the velocity has to be written as a gradient of a potential function. And that exists in Landau's paper, but he never connects that potential function with the chemical potential of the condensate or the phase of the order parameter. Also connected to this, of course, the superfluid was sort of, in some sense, quantum mechanical. Landau quite formulates that in a precise way. But certainly the normal fluid was the normal part. It contained all the entropy and, for instance, all dissipation of the usual kind that we're familiar with in gases, where it's associated with this normal fluid, which is made up, and that's the second part of Landau's great contribution, a thermal gas of quasi-particles. And that's a very confusing thing about Landau's paper. Not only does he develop two fluid hydrodynamics, on the side, he introduces a new theory of the elementary excitations of superfluid helium, which is a separate topic, but again, he was more or less right. So he introduced the famous photon-roton spectrum for this normal fluid. Of course, in our Bose gases, you know, homogeneous Bose gas, that's just the usual Bug-Lebov spectrum of linear phonons, and then, like, we don't have a roton in our gases. Anyway, the normal fluid would have all the hydrodynamic damping associated with the interactions between these quasi particles, and therefore Landau and Flatnikov worked out the transport coefficients of these quasi particles. And of course, there was a lot of consequences of this type of theory. In particular, probably the most dramatic consequence, even though it was initially predicted by Tisa in a preliminary form of this two-fluid model, was worked out in more detail by Landau and also Peshkov around 1945, was able to produce second sound that automatically came out of this type of two-fluid theory, because clearly, as soon as you have two components, you know, it's like having two coupled oscillators, you clearly are always going to get modes which are pairs, okay? Sort of in phase and out of phase, always, okay? You double the type of modes you have, and there's always an in phase and out of phase. And the second sound mode, which is very dramatic, was turned out, you could see from the theory, was a mode where the superfluid and normal fluid moved in opposite directions. And of course, that type of motion, while the first sound, in these terms were first introduced in that context, first and second sound, was when both the superfluid and normal fluid moved together. Of course, this type of out-of-phase mode is precisely, in a more stationary sense, what explains all the famous superfluid experiments of 1938 of Kapitsa and Allen and Meissner, who first discovered superfluidity, which always involved the normal fluid doing something going in a different direction than the superfluid. So that was all very nice. Let me just now just really impress you by writing down, you know, the full set of Landau-Platnikov two-fluid equations. I remember reading something, maybe Philippe knows this, but somewhere along the line, once when Platnikov, who was Landau's student, was showing him some of these results, and of course the results have come out of this, that Landau said that physics seems to be divided into two areas. There's this set of equations and the rest of physics. But in any event, I don't want you to go through it in detail, but we can sort of recognize things. Here we have the continuity equation. Here n, remember, is a total, you know, n here represents, this is our language, nc plus n condensate, or the normal density, and or the thermal density and the condensate density, and j here is nc vc plus n tilde vn. I've already written these, just the only difference between these and Landau-Platnikov, I put this on the side here, is that we find when we do the derivation for the gases, the significance of rho s is mnc, as you might expect, and rho n is the mass times n tilde. Okay? But the equations are more general than that. So anyway, you have that equation. You have, obviously, Landau and Platnikov use different variables than we do. They have an equation of motion for the current here involving the pressure, second-order terms here involving the condensate, you know, vn squared and vc squared. You have this guy here, and this is sort of similar to one of the equations that Claude wrote down today. But then you have all these terms here involving transport coefficients. This is a shear viscosity, eta. This is zeta 1, zeta 2, zeta 3, zeta 4, are the so-called coefficients of second viscosity in the Landau-Platnikov theory. Then you have this equation, which we recognize. That's like comes out of the Gross-Podievsky equation, derivative of Vc with respect to T, gradient of the chemical potential, if you push through M, mu plus 1/2 mVc squared. But you notice there's a correction due to these coefficients of second viscosity, zeta 3, zeta 4, depending on gradients of the various velocities. And then finally, an equation for the entropy, because remember, the entropy in Landau's way of thinking is really the most natural thing to describe damping, and it's only the normal cloud contributes to it. So this is the entropy, the local entropy. All these things depend on R and T. This is S, the local entropy Vn and moves with the normal fluid, the superfluid, the condensate doesn't carry any entropy. Here the thermal conductivity arises, kappa, involving temperature gradient. And then there's a dissipative function which the Landau school likes to always write their things in terms of. This dissipative function is given here, and that's described in the damping, and again it involves zeta 2, zeta 1, zeta 3, shear viscosity, and the thermal conductivity. Well, these are a couple set of differential equations. They can be solved. I mean, if you work it through, the total number of equations is equal to the total number of variables, if you know the transport coefficients. And in the case of the uniform superfluid system, these are the equations that thousands of papers and thousands of people have spent their lives on. Later on, but I just want to write them down now, these are actually what come out of the ZNG equations. But the advantage of the ZNG equations, everything also is given. Mu here, all these thermodynamic functions, mu, all the transport coefficients, NC, everything. I mean, D mu mu here is, of course, the rate of strain tensor involving the derivatives of velocity. All these coefficients are given, of course, by the ZNG equation, and in particular the transport of the coupled equations. So that was a great accomplishment of Landau. Of course, as you know, Landau was vehement, at least publicly, against the interpretation of his two-fluid model in terms of, he thought it was a theory, as far as I can see, of any quantum fluid. Remember, this is way back in 1941. And in fact, had nothing to do with both statistics of both condensation. I think if you had mentioned, I don't know, I don't talk to Landau at night, but I think if I was at the time and asked Landau, well, do you think your equations are going to be valid for helium-3? I think he would have said, he would have said yes. He thought this was a generic theory. That's why he says it's a quantum fluid. And the only time Bose comes into it is in a derogatory way. You know, Bose condensation, nothing to do with my theory. So as far as I know, I think Landau was wrong in a few other more minor things, but I think this was the only major mistake he made. And of course, he had made thousands of correct, brilliant things. I think this is psychological, too. I think he hated London. In any event, it was, as I mentioned, it was London who basically argued that the essence of superfluidity and the peculiar properties of liquid helium is due to this macroscopic order parameter, which we've already discussed. And most theorists, since about 1965, as I mentioned in my first talk, have sort of accepted now that this is the natural microscopic basis of the Landau two-fluid description, and it explains all the strange behavior of liquid helium-4 in a qualitative way, and of course in the Bose gases maybe in a quantitative way. And in that sense, there's no big conflict between London and Landau. Of course, it turns out, as you also know, just to finish this up, direct measurements of the Bose condensate, you know, the number of atoms in the Bose condensate, is actually a little bit tricky in liquid helium, partly because it's a strongly interacting system, and also partly because the only region you can get into easily is, or you can study very nicely, that shows superfluidity is a hydrodynamic regime, and a hydrodynamic regime, NC, in some sense, and N tilde are transformed into rho S and rho N, so you can measure rho S and rho N in liquid helium very nicely, easily. But you can't measure the things underneath them, namely the Bose condensate. So that's also one of the reasons why it's difficult. In gases, we're in an opposite situation. We can study the condensate really easily, and it's the superfluid density we have difficulties trying to figure out. On the other hand, that's why, as you probably know, many experimentalists, but I'm sure Sebastian Balivar and people here are not in that group. Basically, one very famous low-temperature theorist actually once told me, an experimentalist once told me, Alan, he says, you must be wrong, because I'm a big shot in this field. I've got many prizes for my work in superfluid helium, and I'm about to retire, and I've never thought about those conversations. That's Dave Edwards. Okay. Now, the Landau-Platnikov, as I said, was derived in this paper recently by Nakuni and Griffin, and I'm not going to go into too much detail here. I'm just going to sketch a few things, but there's several parts which I'm not going to discuss, which are really very, very subtle, and it was really Tetsuro Nakuni that managed to figure out. Of course, we did know what we were trying to get, and we were trying to get the Landau-Platnikov equations, but from the ZNG equations, but it was very, very subtle, and it really tested us in a sense, particularly when you include hydrodynamic damping, you really have to be very careful how you even define local temperature, how you define local pressure. And in some sense, we think we've understood Landau's even original work better. Now, the Landau equations without damping were first derived, as say, from the ZNG, by ZNG in the low-temperature paper I mentioned last time. And I'm going to make just a few remarks on how we do this. Of course, remember last time, as I mentioned, the condensate is very nice in the sense it's always hydrodynamic, so we don't have to do anything with it. It's the non-condensate we're trying now to go from ZNG, a Boltzmann equation, down to equations of motion such as Claude discussed above TC. And it's the same method. We basically take the Boltzmann equation in a schematic way like this, the screening term times F, C12, which depends on F and C22, and we take moments of it with respect to Ps, where S could be 1, 2, and 3. S equals 1, when we take the moment of the equation, for S equals 1, when we take it, we can, doing the same type of tricks that Claude was discussing, we can get this equation here, a sort of continuity equation for the non-condensate density, where N tilde is defined in terms of Fp of R of T, remember the number of atoms that normalized, number of atoms and length of P of R and T. N tilde is this way, and Dn is defined this way, as Claude points out, but not explicitly, that's the natural definition, that's the current, you know, of J, the normal current. You find this thing on the this from this side, but on this side, it turns out C22, when you integrate, this is for S equals 1, when you integrate S equals 1, Ts there is not there, you integrate over C22, and of course that's 0, because the total number of atoms in the thermal cloud are conserved. This is one of the invariants that Claude was talking about. In contrast, you can see C12 doesn't have that feature because the number of atoms is not conserved. Number of atoms, you know, one atom goes into the condensate or out of it. So you find that dp C22 equals to 0, but the integral C12 does not equal to 0, and that's why you get it here, and we call that a G12. So this is a function of F and the distribution function and the order parameter, but it's really a function of R and T. Notice, though, it comes in with a plus sign, and you'll recall last time when we described a similar continuity equation for the condensate, we got a minus sign, and that has a nice feature, as I mentioned, of course, the two cancel, as they should. So that's the first equation that we get. The similar method now, well, in fact, here I give it. Remember, the condensate equations I described last time, we have a similar one up here, minus gamma 1,2. I didn't give too many details how I derived that, but that's what you get. And, of course, as I mentioned last time, these are the full condensate equations in the ZNG. Then when you combine these two sets of equations for total N and total J, you get this. Okay? So you might say that's one of Landau-Platnikov's equations we get. You might say it's not too impressive, the continuity equation, but all kinds of theories don't even get the continuity equation correctly. Then when we take S equals 2, integrate the whole equation that I mentioned before, let's see here, just integrate this now, where S equals 1, okay, let's sort currents, as you might expect. Then what we're going to do is we get a little bit more complicated equation, we get this one here, we get terms such that you can sort of recognize from Claude's talk about TC, but as you might expect, you're going to get some term involving G12, involving that C12 guy. Here, the generalized sort of, you could call it maybe pressure term, which is a tensor, P tilde, is actually just defined to be this. So this equation is exact. It's an exact consequence of the ZNG equations. And similarly, by doing integral over S equals 3, you can get another equivalent of what Claude called the energy equation. All these equations, of course, are still exact consequences of the microscopic equations, and therefore are valid in the collisionless and biodynamic regimes. Now, we introduce hydrodynamics. We say that we're going to want to study the region of local equilibrium where, by definition, F has to be such that C12 of F is equal to 0 and C22 of F is equal to 0. In other words, the system has got into a local equilibrium form such that the collisions have no effect. Okay, the collisions have already got you into a local equilibrium. And as Claude mentioned, and as I mentioned in my last lecture, it turns out the only solution of C12 and C22 equaling 0, using the expressions I had in my first lecture, is this thing here, the local Bose distribution, where, of course, beta, Vn, U, and mu tilde, the generalized R and T-dependent chemical potential of the non-condensate, that those all depend on R and T. So we've got rid of atoms, and that's our whole point in hydrodynamics, and we've now just got a bunch of a new set of macroscopic variables. We're obviously going to have a set of equations somewhat similar to what Claude discussed, except we're obviously at effects from due to this gamma 1, 2, which doesn't exist above TC. But that's what we want to do. We want to start with this local equilibrium solution. I might say that you might say, well, what happens? What if you had a form here, F, that satisfied C22 was equal to 0? Okay? That's this 1 plus F times 1 plus F is the split intervals. Why do both of them equal to 0? Well, that's because, in general, this will always be equal to 0. This solution here, I should say, will always be such when I put it into C22, I get this thing equaling 0. Where mu tilde could be anything but has the meaning of the chemical potential, physically, of the non-condensate. This thing here actually only vanishes. This thing here only is a solution of C12 if mu tilde is equal to mu c, only if the two chemical potentials are the same. So in fact, I'm not going to emphasize this, but we have a theory here which allows the fact that mu tilde, the condensate chemical potential, might be different than the condensate, the mu tilde, the non-condensate chemical potential, might be different than the condensate chemical potential. They might be out of equilibrium. But in any event, here we're just starting with this local equilibrium one, where the two chemical potentials are there both in local equilibrium. We're assuming that in some sense. Well, just as Claude discussed, one can sort of work out these various things, assuming that F now is equal to FL, okay? And then you can work out N tilde, which is given by this. You can work out this. It turns out to be diagonal. Mu and mu are Cartesian components, and this is the pressure, kinetic pressure term, where Z is the local fugacity and thermal de Broglie wavelength of the gas. So essentially following this type of procedure, one ends up with this following set of equations. I've sort of discussed this first set and second set, but now I haven't written this one where I integrate over the T squared. That gives me the energy, but I've written in terms of this local pressure. So these are the hydrodynamic equations for the non-condensate that I derive from ZNG, but in the local equilibrium limits, I'm assuming that F is equal to FL. Okay. And then therefore, I just got a whole bunch of variables that depend on R and T. And you might say, no, you got trouble here. You got gamma 1, 2. That's a new variable. What is it? But you remember last time I showed, particularly when you do a linearized theory, gamma 1, 2 is related to the deviation between mu tilde and mu c. And you can show that these two quantities can be expressed in terms of n tilde fluctuations and n tilde and p tilde. And therefore, gamma 1, 2 and here that occurs is not a new quantity, but can be expressed in terms of n fluctuations and n tilde and p tilde. So you see how we can get this set of equations, which are not closed. Notice these equations depend on Vs and Vn and parameters depending on the condensate. But we've got this set of equations in local equilibrium for the non-condensate, coupled with the similar equations for the condensate. And there we got it. We've got essentially, and it turns out, we've got exactly the number of equations for the number of variables, and essentially we work in terms of these variables here, NC, VS, N tilde, VN, and also the local pressure. We can also work in terms of local chemical potential. Well, as I said, though, one is able to take those set of equations in terms of these variables and beat them to death and finally end up with exactly Landau's two fluid equations, okay, where it's written in terms of entropy and all kinds of very obscure things. In the limit, of course, of local equilibrium, which assumes that omega tau mu has gone to zero. Very strong collisions. I might say in this derivation, you might think that gamma 1, 2, which is proportional to this deviation between mu c and mu tilde, would somehow vanish. And that's what we thought for about a year, in fact. But it turns out it doesn't, because when you work out gamma 1, 2, it turns out proportional to this deviation between mu tilde and mu c in the numerator, but below it is a relaxation time, and both are going to zero. So, in fact, the end result is finite, and it turns out, I'll just write this down just to pique your interest, that the Landau two-fluid equations that we derive from this theory turn out to, in fact, require that gamma 1, 2 is equal to this expression here, where this coefficient sigma hydrodynamic of RT is a very complicated, non-trivial combination of the static equilibrium thermodynamic properties. So that buried, you know, buried into this this theory is this theory of gamma 1-2, and that Landau, amazingly enough, got the right equation without doing any of this stuff. Okay, now just to quickly, I'm almost finished here. Of course, this is only an extreme hydrodynamic limit, omega tau going to zero, because in that limit, as Claude has discussed, there's no damping, okay? In the limit of omega tau, very rapid local equilibrium, there's no damping, and collective loads that this theory predicts would have no damping in that limit. But of course, we're interested in damping, and that requires us to consider what are the corrections to the local equilibrium form, okay? Let's assume we have small corrections. That's in the classic way of dealing with classical gases, Chapman-Enstock. You consider deviations, because I want to emphasize FL, while it's solved, it makes the collision integrals equal to zero, as many of you might know who study Boltzmann equations, it's not an exact solution of the full Boltzmann equation. So you actually have to now iterate and get the corrections. And those corrections, of course, give rise to things called transport processes, okay, which are not included in the local equilibrium form. So anyway, this was carried out, as I say, by Fitzgerald, including myself. And we exactly get the Landau-Plotnikov equations that I mentioned on page 26. But the nice thing, and that's what I want to end up with here quickly, is that we end up, of course, with all the transport coefficients, thermal conductivity, shear viscosity, coefficients of second viscosity, and we get a whole series from those, and we can extract a whole series of relaxation times, tau kappa, tau eta, tau mu, where tau mu is related to this, how quickly the chemical potentials equilibrate. And once we got those, we can actually describe how fast we get the local equilibrium, and also both of the appropriate tiles to determine, of course, the crossover from collisionless to hydrodynamic, which is really how fast do you get, when do you get local equilibrium. I might say, though, before I go any further, that, of course, once we got these equations, you know, you linearize them to around static equilibrium, you look for normal mode solutions, which are damped. The way we are approaching this, and these are being worked out now, was a method that Eugene Zaremba developed in our 99 paper, is that rather than solving these couple set of 10 differential equations with very complicated position-dependent coefficients, what we do is we develop an equivalent free energy whose minimum corresponds to the solution of the equations, and then the way we solve the equations is find the minimum of free energy, and it's, from a computer point of view, very elegant. So anyway, in that theory, of course, and we're working omega C and I gamma, partly simulated by work here and other places, but certainly work here, where certainly, hopefully, people will have the frequencies, the hydrodynamic mode frequencies and damping, both above as well as hopefully below TC. But of course, it's these relaxation times determine the hydrodynamic description, and in a recent paper just coming out in PRA, we actually, of course, work out all the transport coefficients in this theory. And just to give you an example of the sort of messy things you get, you know, here's the thermal conductivity of a trapped gas, you know, as a function of R. And it involves tau kappa of R here, involves this whole mess here. You see GC7 halves, G3 halves, all kinds of de Broglie things, 15 over 4, various complicated integrals of order 1, but still have to be calculated. Sort of mess, you know. And we do that for them all, okay? And that's it. They're all universal functions of fugacity. And, of course, they automatically correct above TC. You just put MC0 equal to 0. Fortunately, we found, when we did some numerical calculations, that to an astounding degree, we can simplify this mess that for most parameters done using experiments, all this stuff here in green, in this tau kappa, the relaxation time related to thermal conduction, all this stuff here is always roughly of order 1 within a few percent. It's just an empirical result. There's no reason for that. It depends on which, all these things depend on the fugacity. And it just happens fugacity is of the order that experimentalists are using. It's of 1. So you can approximate this very well by a very simple formula that you might think we're cheating, but numerically for thermal conductivity, this is good within a couple of percent. But it's not an analytical result. But basically, tau kappa is tau kappa 1-2. It only involves collisions between the condensate and non-condensate, square root 2, NC0 of R, the condensate density, sigma V bar. V bar is for Bose gas, but it's essentially the same as for a classical gas. That's for T less than TDEC. For above TDEC, when there's no condensate, of course, a very good approximation of tau kappa is this result, which is, of course, 1 over tau classical. The reason that only collisions between the condensate and non-quantum state are important in transport coefficients, which surprised us, it was only at the end of the calculation we realized this is coming out, is simply because the condensate density is always huge, of course, compared to the thermal cloud density. And as a result, the main way the thermal gas equilibrates and comes to local equilibrium is not through collisions between atoms in the thermal gas, but it collides with atoms of the condensate back and forth. And that's what actually makes the thing go to local equilibrium. In any event, you can see, because NC0 here, this is the type of formula, for instance, most experimentalists use. It's perfectly right if you're doing something at room temperature. It's pretty good even down to TDEC, but this is the correct one for this one. The other relaxation times, tau eta and tau mu, turn out to be pretty close to this, but different by factors of one to two. So this is, I think, this is the formula everybody should use. But clearly, this is a very interesting side consequence here, because it means that if when you decrease T below TDEC, you can start well in the collisionless regime above TDEC, and as you lower the temperature, you'll automatically get into the hydrodynamic regime, simply using the high density of the condensate and the fact that important collisions are C1-2 collisions, not C2-2 collisions anymore. So that's a very nice result, which I hope turns out to be true. Of course, the final thing I just want to mention here, and maybe I'll stop, is that probing this hydrodynamic regime, of course, requires, to some extent, large densities, 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 atoms per cc to be okay, and a large A. And, of course, helium, metastable helium is nice because it has an A, one estimates to be maybe 100, maybe even 200 angstroms. So that's what makes it particularly advantageous. So it's clear, automatically, in getting into this hydrodynamic regime, one also is going to have to maybe start worrying about the fact that the condensate can be depleted. That is, you're getting a case where Na cubed, the gas parameter, is starting to be such that maybe even at T equals zero, you have maybe 3 or 4% of the atoms out of the condensate. This is the estimate in the uniform system of von Neubauer back in 1947 of the condensate depletion. Many people have done similar things for the trap gases. And of course, that's very exciting, because while it's been left out of these calculations that I've been discussing these last two lectures, the theory is such that one can include these effects. But I think it's also, this region opens up the possibility that in studying hydrodynamics where the superfluid density, rho S of R, is different than the condensate density. Okay? Well, in the current trap gases, this is estimated to be less than a percent difference, and therefore it's of no importance. And in many ways, it's this distinction, in my opinion, between the superfluid density and the condensate density, and I'm not going to give any details here, but in the notes I've discussed this briefly, but basically, in a very crucial way, it's, in my opinion, this distinction between rho S and NC is really at the heart of our microscopic understanding of superfluidity. So even if there's a difference only of a few percent, it's an important thing. As we all know, in physics, size doesn't matter, okay? But a huge amount of good physics has come out of measuring things very carefully and getting small corrections, which the theorists have told you should expect, like the Lamb shift or something like this. Well, similarly, I strongly encourage all experimentalists who are in this area to really try to seriously think about doing experiments where you can get a distinction where the condensate is depleted at T equals zero, and then rho S and rho NC will be different. Okay? I might say you probably know, in fact, it was first shown and proven factually by Gavray and Rozier many years ago, that, for instance, at T equals zero, even though you have interactions, the superfluid density is 100% at T equals zero. Okay? Even liquid helium, rho S is 100% at T equals zero. Both gases, it's 100%. NC can be less, okay? And it's this distinction, and the reason that this rho S is so important, and I describe it here, and it goes back to my earlier comments, but maybe I'll just leave it here, is that rho S can be related in a very fundamental way to how you describe a superfluid, because basically this moment of inertia that I described earlier in connection with the scissors mode turns out to be a measure of the normal fluid density. And if you get the fact of normal fluid density, rho S is rho minus rho N. And the fact that rho N over rho is less than 1 is very crucial to a fundamental way of defining superfluids and superfluidity. Well, anyway, fini and merci beaucoup. Yeah. Yeah. Sure. Perfectly. Anything like that you can compute, I mean, in terms of these numerical calculations, yeah. It's just that the original experiment of Ketterly was sort of this quenching type of experiment, but it's not really the best type of experiment anyway to do, as you say. You want to set up the experiment to get the most information out, and that's too destructive. A nicer one probably is even to study condensate growth when you sort of maybe just change, open up the trap and adjust the trap and just, you know, and see how long it takes for the condensate to react to that. It's sort of obviously connected to collective modes, but it's sort of like the static thing. And I think in these systems, this whole business of being able to study the dynamics of condensate growth is really nice, because that's a general problem in statistical physics, how order parameters develop. And because you're working with gases here, you have a quite long relaxation time, so I have a feeling that it's probably a promising area of research. Yeah? Well, Landau damping is completely contained, yes. In, for instance, like Zaremba and Jackson, who use our equations, have compared the Landau damping they find to the best calculations of Landau damping by golden rule calculations and agrees perfectly. But where it comes from is, in some sense, you know, when you include the non-condensate in Gross-Piedrowski, the Gross-Piedrowski term, you have the GNC. Well, in the GN, I don't have my slides here, but in the, you know, this is the trap here, you have another guy like this, okay, in the equation of motion for phi. And that's essentially the Hartree-Fock field of the non-condensate acting on the condensate. Well, essentially, this is the origin of Landau damping. This already contains it. Because essentially, this, you see, this can give rise to an imaginary term. But the condensate drives the condensate is driving the non-condensate, and the non-condensate is reacting to it. What have you? This is discussed in several papers. So in this approximation, which is sort of a dynamic Popov approximation, that fully contains Landau damping. It does not contain, of course, Galilei damping. But the whole theory is Galilei damping is important at very low temperatures. In this whole discussion we've given here, although it could be generalized, and it's been done, as I mentioned in my last thing, the student of mine in Toronto, Molina, we don't include Landau damping. Galilei damping. Galilei damping, you have to include terms of order G squared in here, which we don't. Who are those?
This morning I saw the experiment by
yes and no. I mean, that is the results. Remember I showed you the results we had for W. Jin's work. Well, that same, as far as I know, Jackson and Zaremba are right now doing the same sort of calculations for the trap parameters, which is a pancake. It's quite a different geometry. But I think that it'll be a good agreement. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I know those experiments very well. I'm sort of puzzling over them. I mean, they're, first of all, it's Debbie Jin is, of course, one of the people, your competitors here, mainly working on fermions, generative gas fermions, and automatically in those systems you always produce two components. And the work that you're mentioning, I don't know if that's out yet, but in any event, it was work that they're doing in the classical limit, so it's misleading, even though they're discussing degenerate Fermi gases, part of the research program, they're really studying the collective oscillations of a classical gas, a two-component classical gas. Now, it's interesting that all the stuff I've talked about here, the ZMG equations, McCooney and I have generalized all these equations to binary mixtures, which is actually a very rich topic. And that's one of the reasons why we're interested in Debbie Jin's classical studies on this two-component gas, because the Fermi atoms feel quite different magnetic moments, have different magnetic moments, the two hyperfine states we use, they feel quite a different trap potential. And that's the calculation that we're actually working out in some detail, because it turns out, for reasons I'm not completely sure right now, they actually are able to, but they're actually able to go from the collisionless to hydrodynamic regime in their sample quite nicely by making these. But they already have a very simple model which already explains their data quite well. So we think we'll only be able to just maybe improve this stuff. So that experiment, that's a problem in this field. Very astounding experiments within a month or two are explained. It's just probably a bad sign. But that type of thing, for instance, like even in Bose gases, I think a very rich area is to study two hyperfine states for the bosons, and of course mixtures of fermions and bosons and all this sort of stuff. So there's a very rich area of the finite temperature dynamics, both in the collisionless and the hydrodynamic regime, which is up till now really not been studied too much. There's been a few studies at T equals zero of collective modes and binary mixtures. Yes, we already have. Or it's in process. So, in particular, this stuff that we recently dealt with is that Jilla, as you probably know, or Yvonne certainly knows, but Jilla group last year formed a methylated vortex by first making a normal cloud rotate above TC and then lower the temperature. And then as it lowered the temperature below TC, the thermal cloud methylated a vortex or many vortices, what have you, sort of classic experiment liquid helium. And we've done some initial studies where we treated the thermal cloud as rigid body motion. We assumed the thermal cloud was static, except rotating, but it's a rigid body motion. And then the condensate, of course, which the collective modes of the condensate are modified by this rotating rigid body thermal cloud. we made various predictions, although physical view letters doesn't seem to agree with it so good. In any event, what we're trying to do is extend that calculation where we include the dynamics of the thermal cloud. In other words, to allow the condensate itself, the collective mode, to act back on the thermal cloud. And as a test of our study of that, Jackson and Zaremba are trying to simulate the same equations numerically, just assuming, for instance, doing exactly what the experimentalists do, except do it on a computer. They actually, so far, are having trouble when they get just at a numerical level, as far as I know, when they get up to the critical nucleation rotation frequency. As you might expect, maybe things the computer program doesn't seem to like this. But so the answer is yes, they're trying to do this, and they haven't got any results yet, but they expect to get some results.
So could you
explain
the
Does TC depend on? Yeah. Well, TC does. TC does. What's interesting, if I understand your question correctly, too, is that a lot of studies have been done, including people here at ENS, where they take T equals zero and they rotate an anisotropic trap in the XY direction. And then you know the TC of that whole system, even though you're not calculating TC, decreases, I think, what is it? It's omega zero, the trap frequency minus the angular frequency. It's the omega, what is it? It's the center, what is it? Centrifugal energy or something.